And welcome back. There has been a lot of discussion about the rash of measles cases in various parts of the country. No cases have been reported in our area. The highly contagious disease has been all but eradicated because more than 90% of Americans have been vaccinated. Those who have not been are vulnerable. Missouri and Illinois allow exceptions for mandated vaccination on medical and religious grounds. Some resist immunizing children, fearing side effects. Joining me in studio to talk about the fact and fiction of measles immunizations is SLU Care pediatrician Dr. Ken Haller from Cardinal Glennon Children's Medical Center. Ken, nice to see you again.
Great to be here, Don.
Well, we've had about 100 cases. Last count, more than 100 cases in various parts of the country of measles. As I indicated, it's supposedly all but eradicated. Are you concerned about 100 cases becoming 1,000 cases or so on?
It is a real concern. I mean, for those of us who take care of children, one of our, you know, our mission is to make sure that kids don't get sick, and we do whatever we can to make sure kids don't get sick. Our secondary mission is when they do get sick, we take care of them. And measles is, as you mentioned in your opening, an extremely contagious disease. This virus is very tenacious. If someone with measles walks into a room and even just breathes, it can stay in the air for 2 hours. Anyone coming into that room who's susceptible has a 90% chance of getting sick from it. So this is a real problem. Now the thing is that even though we are seeing these cases, strictly speaking, measles is still considered eradicated from the United States because these cases have been linked to people going abroad and getting it in another country, then coming back and then spreading it locally, and then you get this big firestorm of cases and they die out. Over the past decade or so, that's resulted in maybe 100, maybe 150 cases a year. Last year, it was many hundreds of cases. And here it is. We're only in February and we've already had 100 cases. This is what's concerning, is that it's starting to creep up because there are more susceptible people out there, more young kids who can't get vaccinated. But beyond that, others in the population who aren't vaccinated, who then spread it from person to person to person.
The idea, if it's coming back into this country from Europe, really reminds us of the way it all got started here in the first place.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. One of the other things about measles is that when people are first sick with it, when they're first infected, they often don't know that it's measles. The first couple of days, they may have some fever, some upper respiratory kind of sneezing, coughing, sore throat, but they haven't developed the rash yet, and they don't go, uh-oh, this is that bad thing. And so they may just go about their business, and that's what allows this disease to spread.
And it can be fatal. We must point that out. As a matter of fact, when it came to this continent, when Europeans started coming, a number of Native Americans perished as a result of this disease.
Right. And there is some, you know, there are some accounts that might have been intentional that they had done that because the Native Americans did not have any natural immunity and their immune system was not ready for this. The thing is that back, you know, I am old enough to have had measles myself. I don't know about you, Don, but I am born before 1957. And generally in this country, if you're born before 1957, it's assumed you had it. I remember it was 1962. Our family had just gone to see Babes in Toyland with Annette Funicello. Yeah. And I came home that afternoon, developed a fever, and 2 days later I had a rash and the whole family got sick. And my mother says to this day, I think you gave that entire theater the measles. Well, who knows? But the thing was, in those days, there were probably about 1 million kids every year who got measles. And during that time, about 500 kids a year would die of it. That's what's so tragic about this.
And those who did have measles, were they naturally immune from that point on, or could they get them again?
Yes, they are. One of the things about immunity, and this is one of those things we hear, isn't it better to just get the disease and get natural immunity? The thing about getting the disease versus getting the vaccine, there are some diseases where getting the disease probably gives you better immunity. The problem is you get the disease and you get all the risks that go along with it. So the thing is that measles, I remember being really, really ill for a couple of weeks. I remember that the light hurt my eyes. I had a hard time drinking fluids. I just felt terrible. Some kids, about 10% of kids, will get ear infections, and a certain number will get hearing loss from it. Others can get infection of the central nervous system, spinal cord, brain, and have long-term brain damage and long-term cognitive problems from it. So the thing is that getting the disease is the price you pay for that. The thing about the measles vaccine is it's actually one of the most effective vaccines we have, and getting that people who get that vaccine once have about a 93% chance of being immunized the rest of their lives. If you get it a second time, that rises to about 97-98%. So it's a very, very effective vaccine. And in fact, this is one of those vaccines where you might actually get better immunity from this vaccine than you get from natural measles.
I want to go back to the vaccines because
right.
that's the primary reason
right.
we're here today,
yes.
to dispel some of the things that are going around about the vaccines. But there was something I recall growing up called German measles.
Mm-hmm.
What are German measles and what is it compared to measles?
Right.
Rubella.
It is rubella. It is the R in the MMR. Actually, measles, its actual medical name is rubeola. And rubella is another illness that causes fever, that causes a rash. It looks like measles, but it's a different virus. It's generally milder. It's more like about 5 days rather than 2 weeks. The main problem with rubella and the big danger there is that if rubella is contracted by a woman who is pregnant, that can cause major problems for her, the baby she's carrying. It can cause deafness. It can cause mental retardation. It can cause all kinds of problems in children. And so congenital rubella syndrome is one of those things that every obstetrician fears, and certainly every pediatrician who's dealt with it will never forget.
Is there a vaccine for rubella?
Right. The MMR vaccine, that's measles, mumps, rubella. So if you get the MMR, you're immunized against rubella, and its effectiveness is about the same level as the measles vaccine.
Okay. To the vaccine now.
Right.
We've had this conversation before, and we've been hearing a lot about it, but it bears repeating, I think.
Yeah.
Are vaccines, measles vaccines, safe once and for all?
The short answer is yes. They are safe. They are effective. You know, the things I hear quite regularly are, isn't giving all these vaccines, doesn't it overwhelm a child's immune system? The thing is that the way our immune system works is it is working from the second a child enters this world through the birth canal. At that moment, a child is starting to encounter viruses and bacteria and funguses and things like that. And so by the time the kid is out and in the mother's arms, it is already starting to get colonized. The baby is getting colonized on the skin and the nose and the gut with all of these bacteria and viruses. And the immune system is figuring out what to do about that. If vaccines could overwhelm an immune system, a child would not live long enough to get them. It's as simple as that. As far as it causing problems, to really get to the heart of this, there was a paper that was published in 1998. A lot of people know about it. It was written by an English physician, a gastroenterologist actually named Andrew Wakefield. And it purported to show a link between the MMR vaccine, the combination vaccine, and autism. Now, the thing is, Andrew Wakefield has been shown to be a con man. Brian Deer, who is a UK journalist, did a number of investigative reports in the Times of London as well as in the British Medical Journal that showed that Andrew Wakefield, at the time he published this paper, was on retainer from a law firm that was looking for clients to sue vaccine manufacturers. He was actually getting £150 an hour for that. He did not recruit people the way he said they did. They were recruited specifically for this study rather than just being people who came into his office. The patients, the 12 patients in his study who supposedly started having developmental problems within a week after getting the vaccine, Brian Deer found out that 5 of them were having problems months before they got the vaccine and the others were months later. That is, there is absolutely no association. And most problematic of all is the fact that a year before he published this paper, he was attempting to patent what's called a monovalent measles vaccine, a single measles vaccine in the UK. If his recommendation to separate the three vaccines in measles, mumps, and rubella into three separate ones had been taken, he would have made a lot of money off of that. He did not disclose any of that to the editors of The Lancet. And that's why he had his medical license taken away. But the problem is that while I as a physician know this, while the investigative journalists have shown this, on some level this still makes sense to people. And that's what I as a physician have to do is say, where is this fear coming from and try to address that. Now, for what I think it comes from a couple of places. One is that parents don't ever want to do anything that might hurt their kid. And for their kid to get sick because of an act of God is one thing. But if they got sick because of something I did, that would be something that was intolerable. And risk assessment kind of goes out the window at a time like that. The other thing is that for years, the medical profession did a really bad thing. We stigmatized the parents of autistic kids. It's only lately that we're starting to see that there are genetic issues involved with autism, that it is something in our genes that get turned on at some point that have nothing to do with vaccines. That's been refuted many, many times. But the thing is, for a long time, physicians would say to parents of autistic kids, we don't know what causes this, but we think it's you. We think you were a bad parent and you did something to your kid. That caused a terrible amount of distress and guilt and shame among these parents. So when Andrew Wakefield comes along and very cleverly says, you know, you're not to blame. Actually, those people have been blaming you. They're the ones you should blame. That just makes a lot of psychological sense and is very satisfying. And that is the narrative that has been carried forward by people.
But it has been debunked time and time and time again.
Right.
I mean, it has spread like the contagion itself. I mean, it just is nonstop. We'll get calls today, I'm sure, from people who will insist that there's a connection.
Right, right. And the thing is that people will look for a connection. They have been convinced by friends, convinced by other people for their own purposes that this is a problem. The thing is that it simply is not. And what is the problem is fear. So when someone comes into my office and says, you know, I've heard some things about vaccines that are kind of scary, what I'll say is, you know something, being afraid for the safety of your child is normal and natural and healthy. It shows me you love your child. Now, I want to know what you've heard. If they tell me, and then I'll say, well, you know, here's my fear. My fear is that your child is going to get something that we could prevent, that your child is going to come into Cardinal Glennon with a disease that I could have prevented with this vaccine. That's the kind of thing that is just devastating to me as a physician. And when it has happened to parents and families, it is so much more devastating to them. I mean, we have kids who have come in with not measles so much, but the other things that we really see a lot of are pertussis or whooping cough. And we also see a lot of influenza. And we have kids who've been in our intensive care unit for months. I know of one kid who had been in the intensive care unit for a really long time and ended up having to get a tracheostomy to breathe because of pertussis, and that could have been prevented. That's the sort of thing that just tears me up when I see that. I don't ever want a family to go through that.
Are there any other childhood vaccines or vaccines for childhood diseases that are so maligned?
Interestingly, the one vaccine I have a lot of resistance from parents about is flu vaccine. Some parents have told me that they feel that this is that flu vaccine will give you the flu, that flu vaccine causes all kinds of problems. Some have said that they feel that the government is trying to use it to do something bad to us, conspiracy kind of things. And that is something where I have to sit and have conversations with people about that. The third vaccine that is a particular where I get particular resistance sometimes is the HPV vaccine, human papillomavirus vaccine, which is given to kids when they're 11 years old. Human papillomavirus causes many cancers. The most devastating of them is cervical cancer. About 4,000 women a year die of cervical cancer in this country, and that vaccine, if it were given to everybody, would prevent about 2,700 of them. So it would save 2,700 lives a year. But because HPV is a sexually transmitted virus, some people, I think, quite understandably, when their child is 11 years old, are saying, I don't even want to think about my kid ever having sex. And so they resist it. And we have to walk through that about that's why we give it now, long before your child is ever, ever going to think about having sex. Mm-hmm. So we do have a lot of conversations about this, and that's where I hope to bring people along. And if you're having fear about your kids, I want it to be an appropriate fear.
Are there any legitimate reasons for not having that vaccine? I'm talking now about
the HPV vaccine.
No, the measles.
The measles
vaccine.
But
either one.
Yeah. There are some contraindications to it. There are very few. One is an allergy to neomycin, which is an antibiotic, and neomycin is used somewhere in the production of that vaccine, and that and so if people have a bad reaction to that to that antibiotic, they should not get measles vaccine. The second is if you've had an allergic reaction to a measles vaccine in the past or a bad reaction, you shouldn't get it. If a person is immunocompromised, if their immune system is not working, it's not a good one to get because it is one of the four vaccines that we give as a shot that are what are called live attenuated vaccines. That means that the measles vaccine actually has a weakened version of the measles virus in it, and that's what stimulates the immune system to create antibodies against it. If a person has a weakened immune system because of HIV, because they're on chemotherapy, because they have leukemia, it's one of those things where you need to think long and hard about it. Now, in a situation where someone might be exposed to wild strain measles, a person might choose to get it, but it's not without consequences. But those are really the only reasons why a person should not be vaccinated against measles.
We're talking with Dr. Ken Haller, and we're talking about measles vaccines primarily, but I'm sure the doctor will take other calls related to childhood illnesses. If you have such a question, I'd like to open up the phone lines. 382-8255 is our number. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email to talk@stlpublicradio.org. We'll take a tweet at STL on air. We already have a call, Dr. Haller. Let me bring in Haley, calling from St. Louis. Haley, go ahead, please.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question is in regards to herd immunity, and if we feel that's being threatened, and if so, what else can we do to ensure protection of our already vaccinated kids? Should we be getting titers on them, or what else can we do?
That's a great question, Haley. Thank you very much for asking that. Yeah, herd immunity is one of those key concepts in public health that make vaccines so successful. As I said, the measles vaccine has an effectiveness rate, if a kid gets two of them, of about 97% to 98%. That means that even if kids are vaccinated, 2% to 3% of them will not have immunity, and that's just it's just one of those things. If everyone gets vaccinated, the chance of an outbreak happening of those two or three kids sort of being in proximity to another out of every 100 is very, very low. And the person who gets measles because they might have traveled somewhere in Europe and they came back, there'd be very little chance of them passing it. As as more people drop out of vaccination and we get down below 90%, then we've gone from two or three people not being susceptible to 12 or 13 being susceptible. Or if it's 85%, then we get to 17 or 18% being susceptible. And that's when it starts to go up geometrically and things can spread like wildfire, like we saw in Southern California with the Disney outbreak. So herd immunity is really important. When you're vaccinating, you're not just vaccinating your child, but you're helping to keep other kids safe, particularly those kids whom I mentioned earlier who might not be able to get the vaccine. How do we address this? Well, I think it is every parent has to make choices about who their kids hang out with. I mean, if there are people who don't vaccinate their kids, it may be one of those things where you might need to have conversations about is this a good idea for us to be in proximity to them. Getting titers might not be a bad idea. That can be a little bit expensive, and I don't know if insurance covers it. It would be a good idea if it did.
That means
getting a blood test to see if the child actually has antibodies, what are called immunoglobulins, specifically to measles or to any other of these other diseases. At this time of year, the most important thing is just those normal things we talk about, washing hands, coughing into your sleeve, those sorts of things that we talk about with every viral illness. And keeping in mind that there are plenty of other things out there that I wish we could vaccinate against, but we just don't at this point. So those things are always important. I thank you for bringing up herd immunity. That is something where I think we all have an obligation to the people and the community we live with, and that's part of why vaccination is important also.
You've mentioned, Ken, a couple of times so far at this time of year. Is this a particular time of year when measles are more likely?
Well, measles not particularly. Measles can occur pretty much any time of year. What I'm more concerned about this time of year is flu. We're still in flu season. Flu season really goes till the beginning of May. And even though it hasn't been as bad a flu season as we thought it might be, And I'm very thankful for that. We still get kids in the hospital with flu. We get kids in the hospital with pertussis. Pertussis tends to peak at this time of year. And one thing we can't vaccinate for yet, which is RSV, or respiratory syncytial virus. As I said earlier, I just made rounds in the hospital. I saw about 15 kids, and almost half of them have RSV. Hmm. This would be a virus I would love to have a vaccine against. There's so many kids who suffer because of this disease and this infection. And so the thing is that we're not at the end of the road yet. We're at a certain point in history where there are things we can vaccinate against, and I hope that people will vaccinate for the things we can, and there's hope for the future of vaccines against other things that are really problematic for kids.
Right. Well, we can be assured that pharmaceutical firms are working on vaccines for
right.
at this very moment. Let's take another call before our next break, and this was a subject I knew would come up. Katie brings it to us from St. Louis. Katie, go ahead, please.
Hello.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call. One of the things that I was hoping you would address, just to preface, I do believe in vaccines, and mm-hmm. I've had my children vaccinated. But there is, you know, a really prevalent concern about the ingredients in
mm-hmm.
vaccines.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish, in order to get more people on board, that the powers that be would address that and clean them up.
Mm-hmm.
One of the ingredients that's of concern, particularly, is mercury.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you very much for that question. That is something that has come up quite a bit. Is mercury, particularly a form of mercury called thimerosal, is that that was one of those things where people were saying, could this be a problem? The thing about the mercury in the vaccine, and again, it's one of those things you think mercury in vaccines. Holy mackerel! What are you thinking, putting something like that in there? There are two ionic forms of mercury. Without getting into – I was a chemistry major many years ago. The ionic form of mercury that's been shown to cause central nervous system disorder is not the same ionic form that was in the vaccines, the thimerosal that was in vaccines. So that's one thing. The second thing is that even though that ionic form of mercury was never shown to cause central nervous system problems, it's been about 5 years now that it's been taken out of – every vaccine we have. There are some flu vaccines that still have small amounts of it in it, but you can ask for a thimerosal-free version of it. Still, every standard vaccine we give is thimerosal-free. It does not have mercury in it. In terms of other things that might be in vaccines as what are called adjuvants, which are things that help vaccines be more effective, small amounts of aluminum, small amounts of this, small amounts of that, they are on the level of such extremely small amounts that the environmental exposures the kids get by eating something that might have been in a piece of Tupperware that was covered with aluminum foil or other things in the environment are so much greater that that while much has been made about this, one of the amazing things about our body, about our immune system, about the various things that we have to keep our bodies clean is it tends to get rid of that stuff. Again, they're very minute amounts. And what's interesting is that even after thimerosal was taken out, the rates of autism have gone up. So that, I think, has shown conclusively that these things are not really connected to it. But thank you for that question.
You're listening to Dr. Ken Haller, pediatrician with Cardinal Glenn and Children's Medical Center. We'll be back to continue our conversation. We have a number of calls. Please be patient. We'll be back in a minute or so to continue this discussion. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back. We'll be continuing our conversation with Dr. Ken Haller, talking about the efficacy of vaccines. We have had that discussion before. We'll probably have it again. But before we continue this time, here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. Earlier today, Missouri Governor Jay Nixon provided an update on plans for a new pro football stadium in St. Louis's downtown riverfront. Nixon said agreements have been reached with Ameren and the Terminal Railroad to move power lines and rail tracks for a proposed 64,000-seat open-air football stadium. A Missouri inmate just hours away from execution is asking the U.S. Supreme Court to step in, arguing that lethal drugs could cause unconstitutional pain and suffering. The man set to be executed was convicted of killing a female neighbor in 1990. And a federal judge in Chicago is expected to rule today on whether to release a 34-year-old Illinois woman charged with aiding militant groups in Syria and Iraq. She and five other Bosnian immigrants, some of whom live in St. Louis, are charged with sending money and equipment to the Islamic State group and other designated terrorist organizations. The judge says he'll rule on whether the women can travel on her own to St. Louis, where the case is being handled. Otherwise, she'll stay in federal custody and have marshals deliver her to St. Louis. Join St. Louis Public Radio this afternoon for local and regional news and throughout the day on our website at stlpublicradio.org. Now back to our conversation with Sluker pediatrician at Cardinal Glennon and associate professor of pediatrics at St. Louis University, Dr. Ken Haller. Ken, we have a lot of calls. Let's get right to them. Good questions from all of them. Judith in St. Louis, we'll start with you. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. Go ahead.
I was calling to ask about the pertussis vaccine, and I wondered if it was safe for pregnant women to take, and if it would also immunize the unborn child.
That's a really good question. Yes, actually, it is recommended that a pertussis vaccine, which is a killed vaccine or an inactivated vaccine.
That's whooping cough, by the way.
Yeah, that's whooping cough, right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that can be given to pregnant women. It really should be given to anyone in the household where a new baby, that new kid's coming in, to make sure that everyone's immunity is up to date. So if adults have not had a tetanus booster that includes pertussis, they should get that. This, again, gets back to the idea of herd immunity, surrounding the baby with people who are immune to pertussis, because pertussis is a particularly bad illness. Like I said, we've had bad cases in our institution at Cardinal Glennon. In 2010, there was a huge outbreak in California. There were more than 9,000 diagnosed cases. 807 kids were hospitalized, and 10 kids ended up dying, and most of them were less than 2 months old, so they couldn't get vaccinated, but they got it from other people. So that's an excellent question. It doesn't, but to the second part of your question, it doesn't really pass that much immunity onto the baby, so the baby will still need to get vaccinated.
Thank you so much for the call, Judith. Sure. I don't want to digress here, but just curious for your take on vaginal birth versus cesarean birth. Mm-hmm. I've been reading that the vaginal birth really provides the child with those bacteria that you were talking about earlier,
right,
and that the cesarean does not, and that if you have a choice, vaginal is better.
Generally, that's always better. I mean, you know, in terms of complications for the mother after birth, there are certain times where it can't happen. And there was a period where C-sections were going up quite a bit, but that is coming back down again. And I think the vaginal birth, that's the way we were built. And coming through the birth canal, there are a lot of bacteria that are there that start the kids in what's called normal flora going to make sure that the normal complement is there as they go forward in life.
And they're bypassed through a cesarean.
Right. Yeah, but with cesarean, everything is sterile. So,
Now, again,
breastfeeding also helps with that, because when the baby is on the mother's breast, they are picking up some of the bacteria that's on the mother's skin. You know, it's amazing how the more we learn about the human body and how we work, the more we realize that it's not just our bodies, but all this stuff around us that's part of it. So one of the things, also one of the myths I want to dispel about pediatricians and doctors in general, we are not saying that human beings need to be separated from the natural world. We are part of the natural world, and we realize it. And the reason we vaccinate against these particular diseases are these are ones that kill kids. We want to make sure that every kid is protected as much as possible, and we want to give them a natural immune response so that they'll be ready when they actually run into the disease.
The natural world is a pretty remarkable process.
It is a pretty remarkable process.
Sure it is. Back to the phones. Anne in St. Louis, it's your turn. Go ahead.
Okay. I would like to know, I'm 71. I was born in 1943, and I had measles and kind of mumps right back to back. Am I immune now? Would I need to take another shot?
You should be immune. And again, I'm a pediatrician, not an internist. There is currently a recommendation that people at chickenpox get a booster for against shingles, because that's one thing that can come back. As far as I'm aware, you should not need to get a shot for measles. Essentially, anyone who was born before 1957 is considered immune, because everyone in this country got it in those days. So I think that you should be good.
Okay. Thanks very much for the call. Let's try another one here. Penny will join us from St. Louis. Go ahead, Penny. You're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to talk to you about my kids. They mm-hmm. did get their vaccines. Mm-hmm. They're grown up. They're in their 20s, almost 30. However, when I was a parent taking my kids to get those vaccinations, mm-hmm. we were required to sign a form saying we're aware of all the horrible side effects that this could possibly happen from the vaccination.
Right.
It scared us silly.
Right.
And I don't know if that's still in place or not.
Yeah. You know, this is one of those things where... Okay, I'm going to say it. When lawyers get involved, there is sometimes an overemphasis on caution around these things that have more to do with what we call risk management in the medical profession. Of course, anything can happen at any time. This is one of those things where I think if every time you got in your car, you had to sign something saying, I realize that I could be in a fatal accident, I could cause a fatal accident, I could hit a car, another car, I could run into a tree, I could run over a child on a bicycle, I could do this, all of which are possible, you would never get in a car again. So, we do have these forms. They're really more for because we are legally required to do it. When people ask me about this, I will say that, you know, can bad things happen from vaccines? Very, very occasionally, people will have a bad reaction. In my 35 years of experience as a physician, I have never seen a major life-threatening side effect from a vaccine. It's usually swelling, a little bit of fever. But what I have seen is I've seen fewer and fewer kids getting sick with things that we could prevent. Back when I was in residency back in the 1980s, one of the biggest scourges we had in this country was Haemophilus. Haemophilus caused about 10,000 kids a year to either get meningitis if they were a baby, that could lead to deafness, that could lead to brain damage, or a really severe illness as toddlers called epiglottitis, where the throat would swell up and kids would stop breathing and they would die of asphyxiation. After that vaccine came out, that dropped to 500 cases a year. It dropped by 95%. And it is really amazing to me that I have to explain to residents and students what that was like because they may never experience it. Unfortunately, those numbers are creeping up again, and now we're at about 1,500. So for me, what I've seen is that I don't see the things I used to see before. And what I'm scared of is that I'm going to start seeing them again.
We just had a call that we lost from a woman calling. I think it was a woman calling from Macoupin County with a 13-month-old baby. Mm-hmm. And apparently she's concerned about traveling with that baby. Mm-hmm. Of course, 13 months is just over the 1 year
right,
age.
Right, right.
What would you suggest?
Yeah, I mean, I think that as long as your child is up to date with all of his or her immunizations, you should be fine. If you're traveling internationally, there may be other things that you need to do. Actually, the CDC has a pretty good page on travelers. Health. If you go to cdc.gov, they have an A through Z listing, and go to T under Travelers Health. You can put in what country you're going to, and that would tell you what other things you need to do. But for the most part, if you have the standard vaccinations, you're fine. And I know that one question people have is often about why the measles vaccine isn't given to kids under 12 months of age.
Exactly. I was going to ask that next.
See, Don, I can read your mind.
Absolutely.
Fair enough.
Open book.
Yes. Yes. The thing is that, like I said, the measles vaccine, like mumps, rubella, and varicella or chickenpox, is a live virus vaccine. Now, one of the things that that a previous caller alluded to is that some immunity does pass from mother to baby through the placenta before the birth process. A lot of antibodies do get passed to babies. And so actually, in the first few months, babies have a lot of antibodies against many things. It's in the second year of or the second half of the first year of life that those antibodies start to dissipate and kids are becoming more susceptible. One of the antibody components that gets passed over is measles. And the thing is, if you give one of these weakened virus vaccines to a kid who is less than a year of age, it will likely be killed off by those antibodies that are there, and it just won't do any good. So that's why we don't give it generally in kids who are younger than 12 months of age. We can give it, but it's just not as effective. And if a kid is in a situation where they are less than a year old and they've been exposed to measles, then the CDC does recommend that they get
the vaccine if they're between 6 and 12 months of age. And then after their 12 months, they just need to get another one to get a fuller fuller protection.
How do you feel about self-quarantine? That phrase has come up a lot recently.
Self-quarantine if you have one of these diseases. I think that it is always a good idea if you have something that's communicable to be very thoughtful of the people around you and decide what you need to do to prevent anyone else from getting it. I don't know that it is certainly not a substitute for vaccination. I still think that vaccination is important and it's the best way to keep you going about your business without having to go through something like that.
And it's 3 weeks generally.
Let's
take another call. Ryan joins us from Wentzville. Go ahead, Ryan.
Yeah, my question, me and my wife are currently trying to get pregnant, and so I'm...
Well, I hope only she is.
Well, but one of the things that I'm researching is along the lines of the vaccines, and I think one of the things that a lot of people, why they draw criticisms of things like vaccines, is that a lot of these Western diseases that are so prevalent in our society are on the rise, and my understanding is that a lot of them have an environmental trigger, and I think that's where a lot of people look at things like vaccines and pesticides and that kind of thing as causing these diseases to increase. And so I wonder if there is active discussion or research about these environmental triggers in the medical community.
Oh yeah, there definitely is. I think actually you bring up pesticides. I think that is something that probably needs to be looked at more. Vaccines, and if there's one thing we can thank Andrew Wakefield for, is that this has been studied quite thoroughly in study after study after study, whether vaccines cause central nervous system problems or have bad effects. It has been studied so much that there is no... There really is no debate about this anymore. It has been shown conclusively. However, the fact is that rates of autism have risen somewhat over time. Vaccines do not cause it, but we don't know what does. So that is something that needs to be investigated further, and it may be pesticides, it may be food additives, it may be any number of things. We just don't know. One thing I do want to add on that, though, is in terms of the diagnosis of autism, one of the things that has also often been a rap against vaccines is that the number of vaccines have gone up, the rates of autism have gone up. Another thing about autism is that what we consider the autism spectrum today is much, much, much broader than it was even 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago. When it was first described by Leo Kanner in 1943, it was a very, very narrow diagnosis of people who were severely, severely handicapped, unable to relate to other human beings, unable to speak, unable to care for themselves. Now it has been broadened vastly, and there are people on faculty at universities who were in the autism spectrum. If you think of Sheldon Cooper on The Big Bang Theory, he's a character who is in the autism spectrum. So our definition is much broader. People are also much more aware of the diagnosis, and the American Academy of Pediatrics since 2007 has recommended that all pediatricians screen for this at all well baby visits and do specific screenings at 18 and 24 months. So we're picking up more than we used to before. Kids we might have thought of as mentally retarded or just given some sort of generic diagnosis, now we're getting that diagnosis.
We've only got a minute left, Dr. Ken Haller. It's been 60 years since Jonas Salk came up with the anti-polio vaccine.
Well, it was the year I was born.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Well, has there been the kind of controversy around the Salk vaccine that there has been around the vaccines we're talking
about?
Well,
that's a very interesting point, Don. And to a really short thing is our attitudes toward vaccine, I think, have a lot to do with our attitude toward government and toward science. The 1950s was a very different time. Faith in the United States and what we could do in terms of the atomic bomb, winning the war, winning freedom, was much, much different. Since Nixon, since Watergate, since everything that's happened during that time, I think that the issues around vaccine also reflect you know, where we are in our society in terms of our faith in these systems. The thing is that these systems do work. There are systems that if vaccines don't work, they get taken off the market, and that has happened in the past. The vaccines we have now are safe and effective, and they can save your kids' lives. So please get your kids vaccinated.
I was going to ask you, what's your best advice to parents?
There you
today,
go.
There you are. See, you're reading that mind again. Once again, the open book. Dr. Ken Haller, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, my
I hope
pleasure,
you
as always.
Put a lot of people, put their minds at rest over this issue. I hope so.
Thank you. Thank
Ken, Ken Haller with us. Tomorrow in St. Louis on the Air, as the commemoration of St. Louis's 250th anniversary year comes to a close, we'll talk about how it went and what's next. Then we'll take a look at the St. Louis Science Center's collaboration with STEM, that's science, technology, engineering, and math professionals, on a program for youth hoping to generate more interest in STEM-related disciplines and careers. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thanks for listening. I'm Don Marsh.